coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK.
Worth doing badly.
Welcome back to Worth Doing Badly with me, Jamie Krieger, David Weber, and Ethan Stoppenhagen. On today's episode, we will look at the lessons for the sixth Sunday after Pentecost. And they are Zechariah 9 verses 9 to 12, Psalm 145 verses 1 to 14, Romans 7 verses 14 to 25a, and Matthew 11 verses 25 to 30. The reading will begin with, and here is David Weber.
The well-known promise of this passage is Jesus saying, "I will give you rest." And sometimes I think it's so well known we don't really understand what has been offered. I was just imagining that any mythical genie would feel underutilized if his the offered wish was not met with a request for money, prestige, pleasure, or power. Instead, the sad soul would ask for rest for his soul. That just wouldn't make much of a genie story, but in this text, Jesus offers rest for the soul because in his analysis, humanity is plagued by a restlessness. And the cause of that restlessness is the constant demand that we work and work and work to save ourselves, while we are afflicted with an added weight of anxiety. And so in that analysis, what we most need and most desire cannot be satisfied by material and external changes, but only in giving the soul rest from these demands and from the anxiety. And I think there are plenty of cultural signs that while, you know, we don't find people knocking down the church's doors in order to get in on this promise, there is a sense of which our anxiety is pushing us into a realm of restlessness, which is very destructive. So Jesus recognizes that we have a desire for healing. And he says then that healing begins with the immaterial, and it begins within the soul. So it begins on the inside of the person, not externally, and it's immaterial. And only then does that rest work its way out into our lives. Now, the thought that the goodness of life, that life depends upon what dwells in the depth of the single individual soul, I mean, at one time that used to be believed. Now it has been relegated to the cultural margins by soulless materialism. Very few people would see Jesus' words, I think, as offering a real life salvation. But rejecting Christ's rest leaves the world stuck with an incurable restlessness, which is not only incurable, but as I suggested, it's undeniable and increasingly undeniable. So it's worth worthwhile to give some attention to defining what this promised rest is. And we see from Christ's words that rest is not doing nothing. In fact, it rather looks like something that initially looks like a lot of work because it involves wearing a yoke, like being part of a team of oxen, which yokes us or connects us to Jesus. It's a strange way to talk about rest and talking about yoke in the same breath. And the purpose of being yoked to Jesus, Jesus makes clear, is so that we might learn from him. So rest is actually given as necessary for learning. Resting is not doing nothing. Resting is the capability of standing back from required work for the life of learning, and that learning from Jesus would be edifying and building us up. So this rest builds us up by means of our coming to know the God who has revealed himself in Christ and to all who are yoked with Christ. So again, this yoking is it frees us to learn, and our content of learning is not, you know, material. It's actually being in relationship with God through Christ. Yoked to Christ, then we embark on a lifelong learning to live in this restless world in meekness and humility like Christ. These are not aggressive, seize the day disposition. This is the way we live in the real world, in which what the rest of the soul comes out in a life of meekness and humility. And this meekness and humility are modes of rest, because God blesses the meek so that somehow they inherit the earth. And while Mary's Magnificat declared, the powerful are brought down, while against all odds, the humble are lifted up and there find rest for their souls. So this uplifting that Christ promises by being yoked to him takes place in the external world through this meekness and humility. So Christ, he promises to rest. However, at least presently, there seems this promise doesn't seem to be all that promising. The world is still willing to live with a restlessness without the hope of rest. And I'm just wondering, Ethan, if you've got a general theory why we admit to the analysis, but the cure just seems so unpromising.
Well, and my question, I think, goes with that, is how do we as preachers, how do we make people want to learn the way of meekness and humility? Because there's nothing attractive about it.
I would always gravitate towards people that I thought, after hearing them speak, were insightful, wise, that kind of thing. And you ask mm-hmm. them, and repeatedly in my life, when you ask them, you know, where does this come from? Where does this ability to speak as you speak with the kind of insight? And over and again, they would use different words, but they would say contemplation, setting yourself a time. I remember one pastor saying, I take heat for this, but I study for 20 hours a week. And by that, he didn't mean going to websites or things like right. that. It was real. Another professor who was just really good, he just said, I take one thinker and spend on a daily basis time with that one thinker. And for him, it was Karl Barth. And all of that kind of culminated when again, this question puzzled me, because I wanted to be effective at being able to communicate the stuff that I was talking about. And then someone said, read this book, Leisure, the Basis of Culture, by a philosopher by the name of Joseph Pieper. And in that, he ties it to this passage that the person who is going to learn to think and learn to speak has to have the leisure to not be busy, to bracket out busyness, and to contemplate, essentially. That's a very long answer, but that's my autobiographical thing. And that's been the harder thing for me to do. I tend to be a person who gets busy. And that's why I think it's the beauty of this lectionary, that if each week we at least commit ourselves to knowing what these four passages mean and how they tie together, it carves out a place of contemplation. So let me ask you, do you find it easy in your first year of ministry to be contemplative?
It's very difficult. And that's actually something that I've realized looking back and reflecting, is that there has to be that time set aside, even just writing it into the calendar. But even besides that, it's not so much forcing myself to do it as it is getting rid of all the other things that are distracting and figuring out what the priorities are.
if you were to ask me, did you do this? And I have to say, no, I failed at this repeatedly and continually. And it's what we'll get with in Romans, where Paul says, what I desire to do, I don't do it. So this is one of the crazy ironies that Jesus offers this rest. We recognize his analysis of our restlessness is correct. We even recognize that the offer of rest is correct. We just don't do it. And so at some level, it seems absurd or unbelievable. And yet, you know, I have to say, looking back, I wish I was better at carving out time for contemplation and not being busy with things. But it's just so much easier to be busy and make believe that that busyness isn't, futile work. Right. All right. Well, obviously, this is something which is lifelong learning. And the Psalms then are, again, I thank one of my teachers for saying that he makes the Psalms the center of his life. And in fact, he enters into contemplation by just meditating on a Psalm. I didn't ask him if that's his ideal, whether he actually does it, but he was a good speaker. So I wanted to know where this came from. And the Psalms makes it clear. The psalmist says, on your wondrous works, I will meditate. So, I didn't do a word count. I don't know how many times the word for meditate is used in the Psalms, but my guess is that it is in abundance. And as I said, rest is not doing nothing. Rest is another word for being contemplative, paying attention, or meditation. And here, rest means being able to meditate on God's works. And these works are of creation and of salvation. So in other words, when we leave our offices, we shouldn't need to have distractions. We shouldn't need to have games and emails. That it is enough to be able to leave God's revealed word and enter into the world of nature. And there contemplate God's unspoken works. And the psalm divides these wondrous works upon which we are to meditate. So in other words, they don't deliver the truth right away. They require attention, like every good thing. That we meditate on God. The first one is God is the cause of all goodness. And the second one is God is the cure of our badness. So the psalm divides the things that we meditate. And those who know God meditate on his wondrous works, both of these works of creation and these works of redemption. And then the psalm makes it clear that this contemplation changes our experience of the outside world. Jesus promises rest for the soul, but it doesn't stay in the soul. When the soul is given rest, then the body and soul, the human being, is able to live in this world differently. And the psalm makes it clear that time changes once we have this rest in the soul. Time is no longer the measure of the constant dismantling of all that is good. And it's not the measure of the ever increasing dominance of all that is bad in our lives. That's what time means to us now. That's why we're anxious. And that's why it leaves us restless and worried. And we say, what is the world coming to? And we think as each second ticks off, the world is increasingly dominated by the bad. Once the soul is yoked to Christ, the rest becomes, we are free to not do anything, not to worry, but to meditate on the works of God day by day. And then it says, not only day by day, but that day by day then transforms into generation by generation. Time itself has been reoriented. It is now where we focus on God as the cause of all good and God as the cure of all bad. That's the thing that takes the place when we're given rest. This revealing then is expressed in the psalm over and over again as joyous singing. So it amazes me that most people think our worship is utterly irrelevant. They wonder why we care, why we keep the churches heated and cooled. And because everything that is true in the psalm will eventually be expressed in this joyous singing. And the joyous singing is the thing that characterizes the souls that are rest and the souls that recognize that this rest is gaining momentum. It's changing time day by day, generation by generation. And this momentum continues until time is obliterated by the forevermore. Now, as we've admitted, it's difficult to trust. But here's what I find strange. I agree fully without any reservations that there is so much good in this world and that the origin of that good is God. Here's what I have trouble believing. I don't have problem believing that God is the originator of the good. I seem to have trouble believing that God is intent on saving the good things that he has created, that God is the cure of the things which are ruining the good he has created. So I don't understand why it's so easy to see the good as caused by God, but not being able to trust that God is at work in us and in the world to save all, to save his goodness eternally. But I do know that the more I can believe this, the more at rest my soul would be.
So could we say that the work of meditation and contemplation on God's word is God himself working? Because you mentioned meditating on God's works of creation, the work of redemption, and I wonder if this in some ways fits under the work of the Holy Spirit and the work of sanctification.
Oh, why would that matter?
I don't know. It just completed the Trinity for me.
Okay. All right. Yeah, that's a good practice to get into. But what I would hate to do is skip over what the Psalms say, right? Which is fine. We read the Psalms backward through the cross. I recognize that. It drives Jewish thinkers crazy that we see Christ in the Psalms. But we recognize that. That's our hermeneutic, right? But we can learn from people who don't have the cross and yet can see God's presence in the creation, right? And this is something that when I see in other people, their ability to appreciate parts of God's creation. So for example, Ethan, I don't know about you, I will never like birds. You know, for some reason, birds, unless they're ducks, and I don't even know if a duck is a bird, they're just not what I would call something I'm going to look at. Maybe eagles and maybe hawks. I like to look at hawks. But when I go to the bird sanctuary down at the lakefront, it is filled with people who are can't wait to see certain birds, right? And they can spend hours down there just contemplating one little tiny aspect of creation. And I kind of envy them. But so in other words, the psalm is making it clear that just because none of us are able to squeeze the truth out of the aspects of creation, there is, the creation is saturated. And in that saturation, now this is where it's a real question. Do we see when we're contemplating creation that God is at work in salvation? The salvation that we know is completed in the cross. But the psalms make it clear that they see that God is not only creator, he is sustaining, he is at work redeeming. And I think that's kind of the thing I'm really interested in is the signs of God's ongoing work of salvation.
Sure.
So if we switch to Zechariah, there's this beautiful I have loved this phrase for a long time, and Zechariah calls us the prisoners of hope. And he begins by saying we were prisoners of humiliation. So in other words, we were locked in to the process of time in which we are being beaten down. And humiliation, you can see the word humus in there. You can see the word dirt, you know, from dust we came, from dust we returned. So the humiliation is is over against, posed over against the, this hope, which is the opposite of that, this uplifting, this edification, and that somehow we were prisoners of humiliation, and now we become equally prisoners of hope. And it's just such a beautiful phrase and such a desirable situation. This is so, when this text is tying it to Jesus' promise of rest. And it happens when the king comes. So in other words, God's presence, as you alluded to earlier, God promises to be present in our worship, which is word and sacrament, which is focused on study and Christ's presence in the sacrament. That the king comes to us and we become prisoners of hope because he, not only that he comes to us, but in the way that he comes to us, humble, on a humble donkey, rather than, says Zechariah, rather than on proud chariots and horses. So in other words, the king comes with none of the signs of worldly power, but on a humble beast. Now, why this humble beast? Because Christ comes to edify, and edify means to lift up. And he intends to lift us up from the lowest reaches of where we can fall, where our labors have accomplished nothing, and we have been beaten down by this constant demand to work, into a state of humiliation. And there, at that point, this is where the hope, it is at the lowest point that Christ then begins to lift us up. And he begins to lift us up, Zechariah makes it clear, because he's willing to make the sacrifice that supplies the blood of the covenant. Doesn't explain it, but because God is doing this for us, because God is not only creator, but he is saving his beloved creation. This blood frees prisoners who have been bound in their humiliation. And then, and it says to be prisoners of hope. And it would be interesting, I don't know that I'm going to do it, is to tie this in to Christ's promise of rest. How this promise of rest, of being yoked to Christ and knowing God, makes us prisoners of hope. Do you see any possibilities in that phrase for this sermon that's coming up?
What it draws to mind for me is we're looking at, we've been studying Luther's Freedom of a Christian. And to me, it connects to that, where you have sort of that idea of bondage, right? You're slave to all, but here it's shifted just a little to be prisoners of hope. I just have that running through my mind instead of, you know, servant to all, being right. A servant of hope.
Yeah, and then we're bound, we're yoked, right?
Right, exactly.
And so the ascent, in a way, you know, Christ would like us to be conscious and attentive and appreciative and praise and all that. But essentially, the yoke means that we're getting dragged along, not against our will, but the ascent is there. And that assurance is the essence of rest. But then, and this is why I like the Romans passage, because I can really, I can speak with, you know, without any kind of lie here. I can speak of my desire. I can't speak of my practice of this rest. And so, Paul identifies our source of restlessness. And it is the realization that nothing good dwells in me. That isn't to say that there's nothing good. What Paul is arguing is that there is nothing good in me that lasts. There is nothing good in me that does the work that good is supposed to do in lifting me up. In other words, everything good is subject to the law of time and the law of death. And that makes us restless. We just can't find a goodness that is going to overcome the constant attack and the feeling that we are being, our lives are being depleted simply by trying to stay alive. So this restlessness is a sure sign that we know Paul is right. We know Paul is correct in saying we're enslaved to something. We are yoked to something, which he calls sin, which is constantly attacking us and constantly ruining the self that we want to have saved. And Paul describes in, I think, beautiful detail what it means to have, to be a fragmented self. He says it's having desires that are at odds with what we do. So the desires are true. It's the fact is that something in us just does not act on those desires. And that something is sin. And this sin is constantly at work in us. So this conflict generates anxiety and despair because the soul desires integrity. And integrity only means that the parts of the self are integrated into a wholeness. So we desire this wholeness. That's why the promise of rest seems so promising. And usually when we talk about integrity, we define it as the integration of one's words and actions. That's not how Paul is talking about it. Paul's integrity is not necessarily what we would call faithfulness or trustworthiness. Paul defines integrity here as a union of desire with our doing. And then immediately admits that he is a fragmented mess because his doing lags well behind what he desires. And so what Paul does is he identifies himself not by what he does, but by what he desires. We are what we desire. No matter how hard he labors, his doing only leaves him with a heavy burden. And he says this is because the doing takes place in the realm of the flesh, and the flesh seems to be utterly opposed to the realm of the spirit. So what he recognizes is that our works are in the realm of the flesh. They do not accomplish what we want them to. But we also are souls. We are souls and we have spirit. And in that, we can't deny that we desire what we do not actually do. And for Paul, this means that we can't quit trying to embody the desired good, even though it, in a sense, it's futile, even though the flesh will come to an end. That quitting is another name for despair and death. We should not mistake quitting for rest. Rest is the opposite of quitting. Rest is the renewal of the desire and the desire to have that rest be a part of our lives. So, what is it that Paul hoped for? Paul himself is showing us what it means to be a prisoner of hope. And in a word, Paul wanted rest. And he wanted this rest because he recognized just the destructiveness of restlessness. And he realized that rest came to the soul by virtue of being yoked to Christ's promises.
Thank you, David, and thank you for listening. All the podcasts from this series, Worth Doing Badly, are available from our website, lutheranradio.co.uk. Try our app. Go to the App Store or Google Play and get the one that is right for you for free. If you have any questions or comments about our program or any other programs on our schedule, write me an email to manager@lutheranradio.co.uk. David and I will be back next week at this same time. Stay on for more here on Lutheran Radio UK.